First one is related to managing the deficit that you're talking about. You said the Congress has the option of increasing the deficit to promote maximum employment. Should Congress adopt the Bull-Simpson plan?
Yeah, I would talk more broadly than any specific plan. I think that it's important for us as a country to be dealing with the fiscal imbalances that exist in our country. And those fiscal imbalances is largely driven over the longer term, over the next 10 to 20 years, by the fact that we have an aging population. We've set up certain obligations to that aging population, and through Social Security and Medicare, and we're going to have a small tax base from which to collect revenue to pay for those obligations. That creates a tension between our tax collections and the obligations that we've written down. We have to get that tension has to be resolved in some fashion, either by raising tax revenues in some form or by lowering the obligations. That's the tension that has to be dealt with. It is a long-term issue, and I am heartened by the fact that Congress is starting to talk about it at this early date. I think that's very laudable. And it's not just my opinion. That opinion is reflected in financial markets. When you see the kind of high prices that U.S. debt, both real and nominal, command in financial markets, that's a sign that people are betting their money, large amounts of it, on exactly the ability of the U.S. to deal with this fiscal imbalance that I described. I think Bull Simpson plan is one plan that's on the table that tries to get at this. But you know, I think it's the important thing is to have plans and start talking about them. That's what I like about that.
I should have started with this question. With the Black Lives Matter Network, we're all about trying to give people context so that they can focus on problems. But here's a real basic one: who established the Federal Reserve and why?
Well, the answer to that is Congress. Congress established the Federal Reserve through the Federal Reserve Act, and that's and then that means you did. The voters established it. So why does the Federal Reserve exist? I mean, I think its purpose has evolved over time, but essentially it was to provide a way to fend off. The original purpose of the Federal Reserve was to provide a way to fend off the kind of financial crisis that we observed in 2008, to provide a source of liquidity, but liquidity became extremely scarce in financial markets. The creators of the Federal Reserve had observed over the preceding 50 years or so, maybe longer, that the U.S. had been hit by a financial crisis that ended up having relatively adverse effects on the economy, and the Federal Reserve had been put in place to deal with that. Over time, the purpose of the organization has evolved to be more about having independent control of monetary policy than independent in the sense of it's somewhat isolated from political influences. Fundamentally, it's grounded in control by Congress, but Congress is set up as an independent agency so as to insulate monetary policy from the political impulses of Congress. So that's the nature of the organization.
Thanks. So this goes really to much of what you just said in your address. The question is, some suggest that the Federal Reserve Bank has been negligent not to have full employment as a stated goal. And I think you've just given us quite a bit of information about kind of how you define full employment and particularly how it's affected by monetary policy or interest rates. There's only so much you can do. I think part of what you're also suggesting, maybe you might want to talk about this a little more, is if monetary policy can't solve the problem of full employment, what are the other steps that we as a people need to be thinking about?
Well, I offered one suggestion in my talk about a way to incentivize employment through subsidies that are being offered by Congress and the President. Those are not costless. And so it just introduces, you have to think through the trade-offs between what level of employment you want as a society and what are the tools available. I've suggested one. In general, I think there are choices that can be made about helping on this dimension. I think one thing that having more certainty about the long-term fiscal picture is one way, I think, to introduce a level of certainty for firms that would probably engage them more in the hiring process at that point. But yeah, there is only so much monetary policy can do. There are other choices that can be made. Those choices are not costless. Fortunately, I'm not the one who has to make weigh that cost and balances, except in the privacy and voting move, which is up to you as well.
So this kind of goes to that same point, or amplifies on it. Since it's unlikely that Congress and the President will avoid going over the fiscal cliff, what tools and contingencies does the Federal Reserve have or consider?
Well, that's a question that, speaking through an analogy, you draw what I want. I don't accept the premise of the question. I don't think that that's the way I'm looking at things. I think the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, recently released a study about what would happen if we went over the fiscal cliff. The macroeconomic consequences in their estimation for 2013 would be dire ones. Their estimation of the economy would return to recession. I don't see that is a policy choice that Congress and the President will end up making. And so my benchmark, our forecast is in that. With that said, we have to have a plan for contingencies. If I saw a forecast for declining inflation and rising unemployment, as the CBO has sketched would happen if we did go over the fiscal cliff, that would be an argument, I think, for more accommodative monetary policy. Would that be able to forestall all the effects that the CBO described? I don't think so. I think there are limits to what monetary policy can do.
Can you comment a little bit on the Greek and the Euro situation and how that's likely to affect the U.S. in short and long term?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an ongoing saga, and it's going to keep going. I think that I think European policymakers have faced a very challenging situation, and again, I think that they've handled it pretty well. Where do I see things unfolding? My own benchmark outlook is that I think that European policymakers will continue to stay on top of the situation. It's one where it is, I think there's always optimism that things have been solved, and then it turns out bumps keep up and there's more steps to be taken. A strong European economy is an important element for the United States. How does it affect our economy? I think it's useful. I always divide it into two pieces. One is directly through trade. So if Europe is strong economically, demand U.S. goods, that means that firms will hire more workers to produce those goods here in the United States, and that's good for U.S. employment. That effect actually turns out to be relatively small. It's there, but it's a relatively small one. Trade with Europe is a small fraction of our trade, and trade for such an economy like the U.S., which is such a large economy, trade is relatively small for the U.S. as well. So we're talking about a small piece. That trade component is not a big deal from a macroeconomic effect. What you worry about more, and if you look at the Federal Open Market Committee statement, it talks about strains in financial markets developing. What you're worried about is that the fear about what's going on in Europe will spill over into fears in the U.S. markets. That'll make people less willing to hold risky investments like stocks, undertake any kind of risky investments like building a factory or hiring a worker. Those kinds of fears, is really what that's the contingency that we're worried about. And again, we have our monetary policy tools to try to combat that. We also have, if it came to the point where there was a manifestation of the kind of freezing up financial markets that took place in 2008, and I'll emphasize I can't say highly unlikely strongly enough, but we still have to plan for it. We have tools available, just as we did then, to deal with that eventuality.
Backing up to sort of a more local angle, can you talk a little bit about how the Federal Reserve Bank, through its policies and through its regulatory activities, affects local economies like ours here in Rapid City or in kind of the western region, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, that we're a part of?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a hard question to answer, because I think it takes place in a variety of ways. Federal Reserve is engaged in making monetary policies I've talked about. We're engaged in provision of payment services to banks. That's something that affects certainly banks in the area. We have today we had a consumer finance dialogue, which is facilitated by our community development staff. That is another way that your Federal Reserve Bank is working for you. So there's just a large number of ways that we interact with the local economy. I think events like this one really try to, I think, underscore the decentralization, the local nature of the Federal Reserve, that more than any other central bank, what we're about is listening to people in the local community and then trying to figure out how to take that back and make use of it. But that operates in a wide variety of contexts.
In this region, you know, energy markets are big, and the up fluctuations of them, we've seen obviously the big boom on the Bakken oil fields up there. Can you talk about kind of your perspective on how people plan to manage those booms and busts out here?
Wow, I mean, those are questions that are certainly, you know, best handled by business people, because they're the ones who have make the investments, have to make the decisions, and the choices associated with that. You know, I visited City, Montana last fall, and our board of directors is going to be meeting in Minot, North Dakota, in August, as a way to try to gather more information about the area. I think there's definitely a caution about investing in infrastructure within that area, infrastructure that I think would facilitate actually the extraction process. So it's a little bit of a catch-22 that people feel that in the 1980s that they got a little burned by overinvestment in appropriate infrastructure, and they don't want to make that mistake again. At the same time, without that, it's hard to, there's a number of hurdles. You know, it's hard to attract employees to a situation where they don't have good housing, and you don't have good schools for them to bring their families. So I hope that catch-22 in terms of public infrastructure and the extraction processing can be resolved.
One of the ways in which the Federal Reserve affects how the money supply is through the issuance of treasury bills, treasury issues. Should the Treasury issue 50 and 100 year maturity T bonds since interest rates are at an all time low?
Yeah, that's totally up to the Treasury, and I don't want to comment on that. It's absolutely, it's outside my jurisdiction.
This is it goes to the way the Federal Reserve operates again. Do you agree with the proposal to disallow any individuals employed by or owning an interest in a bank to serve on Federal Reserve Board, on the Federal Reserve Board?
It's a very recent proposal, as I said, the Federal Reserve Act, the Federal Reserve is a creature of Congress, and they're free to shape it in any way they want. I will say that, president, I get a lot of incredibly useful information for the banking directors that serve on our boards, and I think that it would be a loss to me as in my policy role to lose that valuable source of information. The people who serve as banking directors, we have a number of policies in place to insulate them from supervision regulation of banking institutions. For example, our budget, our employment for supervisors and regulation at Minneapolis Fed is approved only by so-called Class C directors. Those are directors appointed from the public by the Board of Governors in Washington. So, I think that we already have the right kinds of processes in place to insulate the supervision regulation process from inherent conflicts of interest, without losing the valuable flow of information that we get from the folks that have chosen to serve their country in that way.
I'm not sure of the context of this one, but the question is, how large is the tax collection from the unemployed or underemployed, and why would this monetary policy help?
So I'm not quite sure the relation to tax collection, but I can say something about how monetary policy tries to affect employment. By keeping interest rates low, as the Federal Reserve is doing right now, people are forced to think to themselves, should I save the dollar and earn very low interest rate in my checking account or savings account, or even if I put it in the stock market, it seems like returns are low, or should I spend it? By keeping interest rates low, trying to encourage people to make the decision, I should go out and spend that money. By spending it, that'll lead companies to think, oh, there's gonna be a lot of demand for goods, or go out and hire workers, and that's how you affect employment. So that's that channel of keeping market interest rates low, as the Federal Reserve is doing, is stimulating demand for consumption, as I just described. It also stimulates demand for investment by firms thinking, I can just retain these earnings, and we've been sitting in an account somewhere, getting a very low interest rate, or I can expand my business, build a factory, and grow in that fashion. That's how monetary policy works.
I think those are most of our questions. I'll maybe take a second and just ask you a couple of questions on my own here to help sort of go at some of the things you were talking about in your speech. First, you really talked about two main issues here, as you said. One is the transparency of policy making by the Fed, and the second is this issue of sort of what is full employment and how do we get there with monetary policies. So let me take the transparency one first. Can you sort of explain for us why historically the Fed was not very transparent about its activities? And what's changing to make it more transparent?
Yeah, so I think the answer it has two parts to it. One is simply intellectually, I think that there was a recognition by both academics and policymakers that policy would be more effective if you told people about what you were trying to do and what you were doing. And it may seem obvious, many obvious things seem obvious after you realize them, but it had to be an intellectual shift really within the study of the field. That's one aspect, and one of the leaders in this, I should add, is the man, the chairman of current chairman of the Federal Reserve System, Ben Bernanke. Both in his academic life, as a professor at Princeton, he was someone who espouses very strong. So that's one side, is the intellectual side. The other side is that while communication is always important, transparency is always important, it's especially important right now. The reason for that is, I've described how making interest rates low can stimulate employment. We can't make interest rates go any lower, short-term interest rates go any lower than they currently are. So that means, basically, quoting me, they're close to zero. So the way you try to affect policy stimulus at that point is by talking about how long you're planning to keep interest rates low. So that's really requires transparency. Really requires you to say something about where you expect the economy to be going and where you expect policy. So I think it's both for pragmatic reasons, as I just described, and intellectual reasons.
Great. Secondly, going to the question of full employment, and this is our chance, in a sense, to get some help from the professor on this one. But looking at your chart here of the beverage group, this problem that we have on the right side with the fact that even though the demand for employment is going up, we're not placing people in those jobs. This is what people call structural unemployment. Is that correct? And what are the things that make for this structural unemployment?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a host of possible issues that are involved. But it's essentially that firms, when they're looking for people to fill their jobs, are finding it harder to find those kinds of people in the pool of unemployed. So I'm being a little abstract about it, and that's because I think there's just a number of forces that are at work in thinking about what's at play there. If you're only looking for highly skilled positions, for example, a lot of these vacancies, this is the Swedish case, so I don't want to talk about that so much, but in the U.S. case, of more of the vacancies are firms are looking for skilled people, and more of the unemployed people don't have those skills, and there's going to be you're going to have this kind of shift out in the beverage curve that I just described. I should say, though, when we talk about is it structural or not, it's structural if it becomes permanent. Now, that's very important. And so if you look at this picture, what if in interpretation that people have given to it is firms post vacancies, but they're not really looking that hard because they don't have that much demand for their goods. So that's going to create this outward shift I just described. And then you expect, as the economy improves, they're going to come back. The problem is, and that's the one view of the world, and that's going to lead you to follow more accommodative policy. The other view is, this is a very persistent change, because of characteristics in the workforce, the kinds of jobs that employers are looking for, and the kinds of people that are looking for the jobs. There's a mismatch. That's going to mean this to be more permanent, persistent over time. And that's apparently a picture that we have to see. So that the issue is going to be, the difference of viewpoint is, this is going to continue like this, or is it going to come back like that? That's really the issue. So as usual, Professor, you can tell you the question and not really tell you the answer.